Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And this, I was going to say this hour, but not this hour. Today, this afternoon, Cup of Joe, double shot, a dope yo. What do you think of that, Thomas? Thomas told me to say that just before we went on the air because we got Joe Heschmeyer with us for 2 hours. So apparently that's hilarious to say. Cup of Joe, double shot. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Did you find that amusing?
I was tickled by it.
Oh, all right. That's good. It's open forum. You can ask Joe everything you want, anything you want. Not everything you want. We're not going to let you ask everything you want. We'd only get one call in. But you can ask something that you want, and it can be about anything because it's open forum. 888-318-7884. Do you prefer Catholics to non-Catholics, Joe, for the calls? Or what are your preferences?
I have a slight preference for non-Catholics, but honestly,
really?
I have a real question for good questions. Like, look, the thing that I love about non-Catholics is I feel like the kind of questions they're asking are really exciting. Whereas occasionally, like, I love good Catholic nerdery, as anyone who's heard more than 3 minutes of this show will know. But, you know, that doesn't compare with the people who are just, like, obviously on a journey and obviously investigating something. So by all means, like, everyone should call in. But
well, what
if you're a non-Catholic listening, don't be discouraged by the fact you're not Catholic. I'm more excited about that call.
So call 888-318-7884. But just emotionally, the way you are as a human being, Joe, are you more likely, if a Catholic calls, to be afraid that your answer will drive them away from the Catholic Church? Or if a non-Catholic calls, excited at the opportunity that you might draw them towards the Church of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer because it really depends where a person is. You know, a person who's like firmly Catholic, they're not going anywhere, they just have some curiosities. It's a lower stakes kind of thing. Whereas the person who's like obviously wrestling with their faith in whatever way, and that may be a Catholic saying, should I leave? It may be a Protestant saying, should I become Catholic? Those are more exciting and scarier calls, but I really enjoy taking them.
888-318-7884. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic people, Catholic belief, you want to know about Jesus, the Bible, the saints, maybe you got something you want to know about the Pope. Joe wrote a whole book about the Pope. 888-318-7884. It's really more of a book about the papacy than the Pope. I mean, it's not a book about Pope Francis. It's a book about the papacy. 888-318-7884 is the number. Joe, very important anniversary for Catholic Answers today.
I actually know what this anniversary is.
Oh, you know what it is? Oh, I was going to make you guess.
Happy Catholic Answers Live birthday, Cy.
Thank you. 5 years. I'm a five-year-old today. 5 years behind the microphone as the official host of Catholic Answers Live.
Five nails in the coffin.
I don't know. That doesn't seem like the right thing to say to a person on their fifth anniversary.
I just mean like you've totally replaced Patrick Coffin by this point.
Oh, the coffin. Oh, I didn't. Oh, I'd miss that.
See what I did there?
Yeah, because generally everyone knows don't mention Patrick Coffin when I'm on the air. Oh, not really. Yeah, like a couple months ago, I realized my fifth anniversary was coming up. And I always know it's my fifth anniversary because I started the same week that Donald Trump started as president of the United States. So I just count by that. And so it's like 1 year he's been out. Well, there was 4 years that he was in. So a 5 year anniversary.
Are you announcing to the world that you keep Trump's inauguration as like your calendar? Like you have your own strange,
In order to remember anything, Joe, I have to employ the most ridiculous scaffolding of tricks and techniques just to get my mind to keep a simple recollection. So yes, the fact that I started the same week that Donald Trump started, I frankly think I've accomplished more than, well, I'm exaggerating.
You remember your anniversary based on like when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House?
Yeah, exactly right. Right, my first date with my wife. That's an important thing, the inauguration of a president. I was like, okay, that makes me remember. But a few months ago, I remembered that it was coming, and I said to Darren, I want to do something for my anniversary on the show, but I don't know what. I want it to be something small, preferably something funny. And so I spent the last few months planning, and I have absolutely nothing. I couldn't come up with anything. So I just want you to congratulate me, Joe. And that's all I want. And you did it.
Well, congratulations. So, I hope you enjoyed the kind of 3-day weekend with Martin Luther King Day and, you know, Martin Luther King / Cy Kellett Day. So.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. But I don't think it was Martin Luther King. I think for some reason it was the week later was Martin Luther King Day the year I started. I don't remember how that works, but I didn't make that connection, but yeah, 5 years. Really, a lot. I'd like to list my accomplishments. I should do that. List my accomplishments as host of Catholic Answers Live. Didn't get fired for 5 years. 888-318.
Yeah, I came on the show before you as a guest, and so it's been I've gotten to see your kind of journey throughout. So,
oh yeah, that's right.
Go ahead. No, that's right.
Well, I hosted Catholic Answers Live for probably a couple of years on, you know, like when Patrick Coughlin would be out. So when I would see him, you know, in an event or something, I would try to cough on him and get him to have days off so I could come and do it. But then, yeah, it became official 5 years ago this week. Amazing. Amazing. I really feel like the world is a better place now after, wait a second, in virtually every way, the world is a worse place than when I started. That makes me feel so bad about the job I've done.
It's a good point. It's a little bit of post hoc ergo propter hoc, but I think we can safely say once Psy came along, après Psy, les deluge, you know?
My God. First of all, no pig Latin. And I'm pretty sure that second one was some sort of, it was an attempt at French. After me, the deluge.
The flood.
That was Louis, which Louis was 14th, that? Louis
the Sun King.
Oh, that was Louis the 14th?
I think so. He was just showing his total indifference. Like, after me, let the flood come. You know, like, who cares?
So that's apparently what Patrick Coffin thought. All right, going to calls. Adam in Omaha, watching on YouTube. You are the first caller on my fifth anniversary. Go ahead, Adam, with your question.
Hello, Psy. Happy anniversary.
Why, thank you, Adam. Please hang on the line after this, and I would like to send you a copy of my book, A Teacher of Strange Things, because you were the first caller to wish me and to congratulate me on my anniversary. So go ahead with your question for Joe.
And Psy, the world is better. I'm a Catholic now because of Catholic Cancer, so I'd say the world is better since you've been a radio host.
Oh, that's what a very kind thing to say. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it also has devolved into a complete pandemic and inflation and near warfare in Europe. But other than that, it's going very well, Adam.
Well, we're all in this together, but my question is, for Joe. Joe, so my question is about, the concept of adverse possession in English common law.
Sure.
And I was wondering, from a Catholic perspective, is adverse possession, you know, to take adverse possession of somebody's property or a part of somebody's property moral?
That's a really good question, and I've never seen any kind of detailed treatment of it. So the basic idea for people who aren't familiar, this is like related to the idea of what's called squatter's rights. If someone is not using a piece of land and you set up shop on it, and your usage is what's called open and notorious, like you're not secretly using it, you're openly using this land and they don't kick you off of it, after a certain period of time, you just become the legal owner of it. And the idea is like, you're the actual one using the land. And so this often works for things like it's related to like easements and stuff too. If like the way you get down to the river is cutting across this property and you're always using it and you're very open about the fact you're using it, at a certain point, it just becomes like a public easement, or it becomes like an easement you can use. And so the idea is actually built on something that Catholics agree with, which is that property rights are not absolute. And so someone may be the legal holder of land, and if they're not using it and someone else actually is, at a certain point, the law just reflects the reality. Well, here's the person who the land is actually helping, who is actually taking care of it, and so forth. So I think there's a good case to be made for it. Like, if you want to protect yourself from adverse possession, take care of the land that you own. And if you are so negligent of your own property, that's kind of on you.
Wait, Adam?
Probably to push a button.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you just kind of faded out on us, Adam, there. Or were you just stunned by the answer?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's a good answer. I expected you to take kind of the other side of things, like, oh, yeah, stealing, or, you know, because adverse possession, if you're on the receiving end of it, you know, if somebody has a fence on your property or something, I guess if, you know, it was a case in, like, a residential neighborhood where somebody, you know,
tricked somebody.
Like, you don't know if somebody is using your land as an easement. Like, could that be, you know, because
kind of this is why it has to be open and notorious. They, like, the law tries to protect against the kind of cases you're talking about where someone just kind of tricks you out of your land. And look, it's not perfect. It's possible for adverse possession to be done in an immoral way. But I think the general principle of it is trying to respect the fact that property rights aren't absolute. And so if you're not taking care of your property and somebody else is, that at a certain point you've simply ceased to be the owner of that property. So it's not stealing, because the law actually provides this mechanism to take it. I know it sounds very strange, but, you know, theft is unlawful taking, and this is lawful taking. That, you know, if you're not using it and I do use it, at a certain point it goes to me. Now, obviously, there are ways that, you know, the strong can use that to oppress the weak, like they can use any kind of legal remedy. But I think the idea of it, despite its name, like adverse possession sounds like a polite word for theft. But despite its name, I think it actually is morally legitimate and defensible.
Hang on, Adam, we'll send you that book. Just hang on and give your information to Thomas. That one thing you said there, Joe, it seems to me so rooted in the Catholic understanding of all kinds of property, but it's very un-American what you said. And this is one of those ways where being Catholic is not always the same as being American, that possession or property ownership is not an absolute. And yeah. The church has always taught that, but it's hard for us modern Americans to accept that.
It is. I mean, I think people are often very surprised to find this in English and American common law, that Americans historically and English people before us have historically recognized this feature, that property rights are not absolute. And if someone else is using it and you're not. But nowadays we think we have this very like, well, it's enshrined. This is your property and it's immutable. And that's just not the historic view that the church takes or that the courts have taken.
Adam, thanks. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum for Joe Heschmeyer right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Bonjour. Welcome back. Joe just mispronouncing some more French during the break. It's always fun to hear Joe speak French. I think that's what you were doing, right? Speaking French?
Yeah, something like that.
Open forum means anybody can call with any question at all. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Michigan. Lexton in Michigan. Lexton, are you there with us?
Yeah.
Hello. How old are you, Lexton?
10.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Heschmeyer.
Do we have any proof that Jesus walked on earth?
Oh, that's a great question, Lexton. Yes, we do. So the first thing we should talk about is what we mean by proof in this kind of context. That when we're talking about historical claims, you know, if someone said George Washington was the first president, I can't do a lab experiment to prove that. And so sometimes when people talk about proof, they're expecting proof to look like science. And scientific proof works really well for science, and it works really poorly for everything that isn't science. So when we're talking about Jesus walking on earth, that's a historical question. So we're looking for historical proof. What does historical proof look like? Well, it looks oftentimes like eyewitnesses and other kind of written records. So if I want to know, you know, who was Caesar Augustus? Well, I can read the written records of people who knew who he was or who wrote about his life afterwards. And, you know, a skeptic could say, well, maybe everybody's lying about that. But if they were, then you would expect to find a bunch of other people writing saying, hey, that never happened. That person didn't exist, you know, and we don't see anything like that. So we reasonably assume that Caesar Augustus existed. So in the case of Jesus, we have the writings of his earliest followers in the New Testament who write about what he did, who he was, and all of that. We also have writings from other Christian sources from early on that aren't in the New Testament. For instance, Pope Clement has a letter in about 96 AD. This is still within the time in which people would remember if Jesus had walked the earth or not. In 1 Corinthians 15, I should mention, St. Paul talks about hundreds of people who were eyewitnesses, who didn't just see Jesus walk the earth, who actually saw the risen Christ. And he mentions that most of them are still alive. And the reason he mentions that is that he's inviting his readers, if they don't believe him, that there's people they can actually talk to who saw Jesus. And so there's a lot of eyewitness evidence there. We also have sources like the Jewish sources, Josephus, and Roman sources, Tacitus and Pliny, who mentioned Jesus as well. In addition to that, historians are also going to look at the phenomenon of Christianity. And what I mean by that is that there's no question that Christianity as a movement arose in the first century, that before the first century, there's zero Christians. And then in the first century, Christianity really takes off as a big religion. And historians are going to say, well, if Jesus didn't exist, it doesn't seem like that would happen. It doesn't seem like you would get a big movement of people following a guy who didn't exist that close to his own lifetime. So I don't know, Lexan, if that answers your question in the way you're envisioning it, but that would be where I would look in terms of historical evidence. There's more that we could go into, but that's kind of the basic overview.
Okay, Lexan?
Did you know that George Washington wasn't the very first president?
Are you thinking of the Articles of Confederation?
No, there was 8 presidents before him.
Before the Constitutional Congress. Yeah, that's very good trivia.
Wow.
Actually, you're yeah. Dead on with that. Yeah, it depends how you
anyway,
define president.
Thank you for answering my question.
You're very, very Absolutely. Welcome. I like this guy, 10 years old, and knows that there were presidents of the Continental Congress, or of the Congress of the United States before there was the Constitution was ratified. Nice going, Lexan. You're really smart.
Yeah, I like Lexan.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Man. You thought for just a second there, you thought Lexan was like a conspiracy theorist, right? You're like, George Washington wasn't the first president. What? No, he's referring to something else.
He wasn't born in the U.S. So
yeah,
Lexan,
we should have asked
George
him what
Washington's
he thinks about the Apollo landings. Ah, well, we missed a chance. Ken in Texas, listening on Armor of God Radio. You are next. Ken, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Howdy, howdy. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, I've been kind of reading the Gospels, and I know no less than twice Jesus says that John the Baptist is Elijah. And if I remember right, Elijah was, well, taken up to heaven in a chariot, but that's not the question. Question is, if John the Baptist is Elijah, one, why didn't John seem to know Elijah? And then also, how is this different than reincarnation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And King Herod was actually stumped by that as well. He killed John the Baptist, but then when Jesus was preaching, he thought Jesus might be the reincarnation of John the Baptist. So there clearly were some Jews who would kind of entertained thoughts of reincarnation. And one of the reasons is, like, the Old Testament promises before the Messiah that there will be an Elijah that is to come. Now, that's a figure. It doesn't literally mean that the person Elijah will be reincarnated or that he'll come down from heaven. And that's actually key to understanding this. In the Gospel of John in John 1, John the Baptist clarifies that he's not Elijah in the sense of being the reincarnated Elijah. But Jesus is clear that John is Elijah in the sense the Old Testament scriptures refer to an Elijah coming before the Messiah. So Matthew 11:14 talks about John being Elijah in that sense. He's not literally the reincarnation of Elijah. He's rather serving the role of Elijah. Elijah was the greatest of the prophets, and John is even greater than Elijah. So he fulfills that Elijah role in proclaiming the coming of the Messiah, which is what had been promised in the Old Testament. But he's not literally the same guy reincarnated.
Cool, cool. Yeah, good answer. That makes sense. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ken.
Great.
Thanks very much. Open forum. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. We go now to Chris in Casper, Wyoming, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Chris, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Joe, I am enjoying your book, The Early Church was the Catholic
Church.
Thank
you very much.
And I've passed that along to one of the folks in the RCIA class because they had some questions and I knew it would help them. But I am a lifelong Catholic, but I also help with the RCIA here. And we were talking about baptism on Sunday, and of course we talked about baptism removing original sin, but you're left with concupiscence, which is our tendency to sin. So one of the candidates asked, so I think of original sin as being on the soul and concupiscence being more psychological. Can you help me with that? Is that kind of the right way to talk about that, or is there something else I should be talking about?
That might be. It might be a good way to think about it. I'm trying to kind of parse through what they mean by that. There's a disposition where there's a turning towards or an inclination towards sin, which you're right. Like, it's psychological in a way, but it's also a weakness of the will so that we're inclined towards sin. So I think we wouldn't want to just pathologize it like it's just a mental disorder or something. It means we really do long for things that aren't good for us. And that remains with us even after baptism, as any Christian, I think, knows. So in that sense, depending on what they mean by psychological, it clearly works at the level of the psyche. And it isn't itself a sin, but giving into it is a sin. So it shows a weakness of the intellect, a weakness of the will, a disposition towards sin without itself being sinful. I think I would just put it in those terms because, for me at least, I think that's clearer. Whereas calling it psychological, it depends what the person means by it, I think. Okay. So I don't know if that helps or not.
It does. And one of the things he mentioned was, you know, it almost means that you have a problem to sin, you know, a psychological problem to sin. And that's the part that was bothering me because, I sin a lot and I don't think I have a psychological problem. So
I mean, in one sense, there is a psychological problem in sin. Like, if you think about the fact that, like, you want a thing that isn't good for you, and your whole life is convincing yourself to want things that are actually good for you over things that aren't, there's something really strange and disordered about all that. But we don't want to suggest it's somehow abnormal. It's something that every fallen person deals with. And so in that sense, I think my fear would be making it sound too clinical, would make it sound less universal than it is as an experience.
Thank you. The clinical word is works for me. I got that. Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Thanks. Thanks very, very much. And thanks for the kind words about Joe's book, too, and sharing it with someone else. I think that, Joe, we're just hearing so many good things about that book, and I'm sure that it does help many people. I think, Joe, you know what I think? The book I'm talking about, by the way, is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. I actually think most Christians, for whatever reason, think that the earliest centuries of the church are just clouded in like mystery, and there's no way to penetrate that mystery. They don't realize that there's a lot of writing from that time that can get you right back to the old times.
There are actual Protestant seminaries that do church history classes that they just begin. Either they'll do like the apostles, and then they'll jump to the Reformation. And I point this out in the book, like one of the reason people think that it's so clouded in mystery is that a lot of Protestants skip over three quarters of the history of the church. And I point out in the book that would be like starting a U.S. history course with the election of JFK in 1960. Like, you're three quarters of the way through the story. And so if you were trying to make sense of the U.S. Constitution, starting with like the Warren Court, that's just not a good place to start. You're too far into it. If you want to make sense of what the U.S. is or what our story is, you got to go back to the very beginning, not start three quarters of the way through.
The early church was the Catholic Church. Joe Heschmeyer's latest book. It's available now wherever you get your Catholic books or shop.catholic.com. We'll take a quick break. There's lots of folks on the line. So you got to speed up your answers, Joe. Coming back with more Open Forum, Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow on More to Life, it's all about me.
Are you dealing with narcissistic people in your life? We'll help you find ways to cope.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. My 5th year anniversary on Catholic Answers Live, Darren did some math before the break, and he says that the number of hours I've done, Joe, on in front of this Catholic Answers Live microphone would be 108 days if you just lined them all up nonstop. 108 straight days of doing Catholic Answers Live.
I bet there are listeners who have heard all 108 days worth of Catholic Answers Live out there.
Well, God bless them if they have. I can think of a few hours. I'm not going to name the guests where it felt like 108 days just to get through the hour with them. But I'm not going to name them.
I don't want to brag, but this is going to be the greatest hour out of that 108 days.
Really?
We'll find out. I mean, let's see what the guests have.
All right.
If it's not, I'm going to blame all the callers.
All right. Let's go to Ethan. Right. That's right. If we don't do a great show, it's the caller's fault. I think that's a good strategy, Joe. Yes.
Yeah, it's very humble, very Christian.
Yeah. Like when I go home,
no further questions.
I go home and my wife says, how was the show? I could just say, well, the callers blew it. They were terrible. Ethan in Cincinnati watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Ethan. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, if I tell it, happy 5-year anniversary.
Thank
I like to think that the show today is like a 5-year anniversary party.
Amen. I like that.
Joe, stay out of this. Me and Ethan are talking. Ethan's way nicer to me about this than you are, Joe. Okay, Ethan, let's just ignore Joe for a while. Ethan, that was so nice. Have you ever read my book, A Teacher of Strange Things?
No.
I want to send you a free copy of it then to say thank you for those nice congratulatory words. Don't tell me no. By the way, don't say no thanks. I don't want it.
I didn't hear him say anything like, I really want that. Just
casually hang up when the call is over if you don't want it. Don't mention anything on the air because that will ruin my anniversary. Ethan, go ahead with your question for Joe.
So, Joe, my question is, what's the difference between the ordinary and the extraordinary magisterium?
Ah, that's a great question. The ordinary magisterium is the day-to-day teaching office of the church. Paragraph 892 of the Catechism talks about that, like the ordinary magisterium teaching things as they normally do. And that's contrasted with the extraordinary magisterium, which are, you know, when the church is very carefully dogmatically defining something, for instance, in an infallible papal declaration or at an ecumenical council, those kind of special moments where the church says, we declare and define X, Y, Z, that's the extraordinary magisterium. Does that distinction make sense? It's not just the data. You know, the magisterium is the teaching authority of the church. The teaching of the authority of the church is there every day when you wake up. But not every day is the Pope defining something infallibly or giving some sort of infallible teaching. Not every day is the church meeting in an ecumenical council and defining something.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes very much sense.
All right. Well, that's good. That's good. Not everybody feels that way after Joe answers a question. So I'm going to put that one in the win column, Ethan. Hang on for your free book. And if I see you hang up, he's not hanging up. He's still holding. I got him on hold. And no, I think he's going to take the book, Joe. I think he's going to take the book. George in Kansas.
This is what people call in for, to find out if people are going to take the book.
Watch it on YouTube. George, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, Si. Hi, Joe. And Joe, why'd you have to say that? You blew me out of the water. Come on. But happy anniversary, Si. And thanks to Catholic Answers, I am Catholic today. So I just wanted to say that real quick.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Amen, brother.
Well, that's
awesome.
A very
what part of Kansas are you from?
Oh, I'm within the Wichita Diocese.
Okay. That's an okay diocese. I'm in KCK, so we got a rivalry, but they're really good. They're actually a phenomenal.
That's not the spirit of love and charity that Christians. Go ahead, George. Sorry.
I was going to say I'm still new. I don't know anything about that yet. So
no, they're a fantastic diocese. They really are.
Okay, so my question for Joe was okay. So we're going to dive back into medieval history here, probably in the 9th century. So. Okay. As a Catholic, I fully respect the position of the papacy, but is it okay to disagree with the one in the Pope's position at the time? And I want to shoot back to, as an example, the Cadaver Synod as an example.
Yes.
Wait, are you questioning the wisdom of the Cadaver Synod, George?
It was interesting.
Well, yes, I guess that's one way. You're a very charitable person, George. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah. Yes. So that's a great example, George. So for those who maybe are not as familiar with history as George, a pope who was embittered towards his predecessor had him unearthed, dug up, put his skeleton on trial and found him guilty. He didn't say anything in his own defense and then cut off his fingers of blessing. Nullified his papal decrees and then threw his body in the river. And many people find that very unseemly, very unpapal, even unchristian, that it seemed petty and it's an embarrassment, right? And it's totally okay to believe all of that. And the example I would give is think about the papacy in its etymological term. Like papacy comes from the word for papa. You should respect your dad. You should respect your father. You should respect the institution of the family given to us by Christ. That doesn't mean you have to think everything your dad does is smart, or everything he does was the best course of action, or the wisest thing to do. But there are, throughout history, things that the Pope does that aren't good. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that and to respect the papacy and even the person of the Pope, even while recognizing he's going to make some mistakes, he's going to do some silly things from time to time. Even very good, very holy popes, that's going to be true of. I don't think you need to excessively focus on that, but I don't think we need to pretend like that part doesn't exist.
George?
Does that help, George? Okay, great.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, what might help is a copy of Joe's book, Pope Peter, too, where he goes into a good deal of the history of the papacy and also the theology of the papacy. So if you'd like a copy of that, you can just hang on and we'll send it to you. If you would not like a copy of that, you can have a copy. What, do you know where I'm going, right? You could have a copy of my book, A Teacher of Strange Things. You get to pick, but you don't have to do it on the air. You just tell Thomas which one you want.
Oh, okay.
You can do it on the air if you want to.
I kind of want you to, but that's why I haven't put you on hold yet. But it's up to you. Whatever you want to do, George.
Well, if there is an all of the above option, I'd do that too.
George, are you in the diplomatic service? You're amazing, George.
Everyone tells me I should be a politician, but I don't like being called a liar.
Oh, and then he went there. After all that charity, he went there. All right, George, now you're on hold, so you can pick the book that you want. And then Thomas is going to tell me later which one you picked, and Joe's going to laugh about it, because Joe always laughs about the fact that people pick his book and not my book. 888-318-7884, the number. It's open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is here as our guest, and you can ask anything you want, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not. As a matter of fact, I probably don't stress that enough, but if you're not a Christian person and you have a question about basic things like why we believe in God or why we would believe that Jesus's claims that he's God are true, all that is welcome. Ask any question you want. Rachel in Virginia is next. Rachel, thank you so much for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, yes, thank you so much for taking my question. So my question has to do with the Eucharist. Specifically, it's a little strange, but why didn't the apostles literally eat Jesus's body after he had died? Because he did call himself the bread of life, and he says that his flesh is true food and his blood is true drink.
Ah,
that's a really good question. You're the first person to ever ask me that, Rachel.
Really, Joe? That doesn't come up a lot?
Yeah, I know. So Aquinas actually looks at whether the apostles could have had Mass on Holy Saturday. And so he actually explores a kind of an adjacent question to that. But Rachel's question is just like straight up cannibalism.
Well,
like,
the thing is, though, but if he said to them, I kind of see where Rachel's coming from. I didn't know where this was going. Like, he said to them, my flesh is true food. And so why didn't they just eat it? I mean,
I think in terms of the psychology of the apostles, one answer is going to be they were pretty confused about everything on Holy Week. Like, the Messiah just got crucified, and they didn't have a clear understanding of what that meant or why or what was going to happen next. And the resurrection seems to have come as a surprise to them. It wasn't like they were sitting there waiting, saying, oh, we totally get what's going on. It's only in light of the resurrection that all of his prior teaching kind of makes sense. And they can say, oh, I get what he meant by that. You know, for instance, when they're coming down the mountain of transfiguration, he talks about how the Son of Man must suffer and die and rise again. And they're debating among themselves what that metaphor means. The answer was, it wasn't
not
a metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's part of the answer. The other is St. Augustine talks about this in his tractates on the Gospel of John, that when Jesus says, he gives the bread of life discourse and then explains that the Spirit gives life and not the flesh. And this is in John 6:63. It sounds on the surface like he's just contradicted everything he's just said. He just said the flesh that I'll give for the life of the world, or the bread that I'll give for the life of the world, my flesh. And so he's just talked about the value of his flesh. And then he says, well, it's the Spirit. And Augustine's point is that it's the flesh animated by the Spirit, and that Jesus is sharing a Eucharistic teaching that shouldn't be mistaken for cannibalism, that he isn't saying if you just come up and like cut off part of his flesh against his will, that you'll therefore live forever. That it's rather this gift of himself in the Eucharist, that it's the flesh animated by the Spirit. I'm very, very heavily paraphrasing Augustine here, but that's kind of the idea, that cannibalism is not what he's trying to teach. Nevertheless, we should recognize that the teaching that he is giving is close enough that it can be mistaken for cannibalism, that he has to explain that it isn't cannibalism, that Augustine has to explain that it isn't cannibalism, and that early opponents of Christianity accused us of cannibalism. So anyone holding to the teaching of Jesus should have the kind of Eucharistic teaching that can be misunderstood as cannibalism, but isn't. And so in other words, if you have a purely symbolic view, your view isn't strong enough to be mistaken for cannibalism. If you have the Catholic view, it is strong enough to be mistaken for cannibalism, but isn't. I don't know if that helps at all, Rachel, but that's the idea. Like, cannibalism isn't what he's teaching, but it's clear why people could have misunderstood it in that way.
Okay, yeah. It goes back to the spirit part, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
that is, it's his free gift of offering, not just like stealing his flesh against his will or something like that.
Right. Yeah, that really does help. And also, I'll look into Aquinas, too, because I didn't know about him either.
Oh, great.
All right. Well, thank you, Rachel. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, that was it's such an interesting, because it's a question about the mindset of the apostles, really. Mm-hmm. Like, why did they not understand what Jesus was teaching to be cannibalism? But and it seems to me that the bulk of your answer was that actually they were incomprehending about the whole thing. They just didn't know what to make of any of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first part. The second part is like, even if they had correctly understood it, Jesus wasn't trying to tell them, cut me up when I've died. That's not what he's calling for in John 6.
Right. Well, all right, we got to take a quick break. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's open forum. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Steve Liegers, president of Tri-State Catholic Radio, and I am a sinner. A sinner who needs God's grace and mercy, especially when I'm weak or disappointed in myself or have hurt others. Catholic Radio and its wonderful variety of programming reminds me that God loves me and uses radio as a medium to broadcast his love and encouragement into our world. Find a Catholic station in your area and tune in.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, the author of a bunch of very fine books, including Pope Peter, including A Man Named Joseph, and including his most recent book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, which we've mentioned a couple times, and some folks have mentioned how much they've enjoyed it. It really is a very, very worthwhile read, especially if you want to know, if you want to pierce some of that. I really don't know anything about the earliest centuries of the Catholic Church, of the Christian faith. Joe does a great job of piercing that by sharing the writings of the earliest fathers of the church. And now I have this little note in front of me. You can get The Early Church Was the Catholic Church for a very special price right now at shop.catholic.com. Our price beats Amazon's. I don't know what the very special price is. They didn't tell me that. They just said there's a very special price right now at shop.catholic.com. Well, a very special price, I suppose, in a certain way, $1 million would be a very special price. But I don't think that's what they mean. I think they mean a very special reduced price.
Well, yeah, we don't know which direction it beats Amazon. Like,
yeah, right.
We're going to get
right.
way more money
like,
than
if
Amazon.
If we get $1 million, we did really well. No, I don't think that's what they mean, although that would be special.
Yeah, it would be a very special price. You know, in Rome, they do this all the time. The vendors on the street will just say, for you, special price. And I'm like, okay, but is it good? Like,
yeah, is it a good special price? Does and not mean good. That's
usually not.
I think we've established that. But I think they do mean good price. Shop.catholic.com. The early church was the Catholic Church. Up next, all the way to Guam. Edison in Guam, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Edison, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, how blessed nice morning, to speak with Mr. you.
Yeah, blessed morning to you guys, Mr. Heschenmeyer and Mr. Kellett. From where America's Day begins.
From where America's Day begins in Guam, yeah.
That's a great, yeah.
Sun comes up like there, that means the sun came up on America. Well, how nice. I just want to ask you this, Edison, and if it's a dumb question and if I'm completely off, please forgive me, but I know they heard that volcano all the way over in New Zealand. Did you guys over in Guam have any effects from that volcano that exploded the other day?
Not that I know of. No, never even heard that yet.
Oh, okay. All right. That's good.
Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I'm going to go look at a map later and I'm probably going to go, oh, that was kind of obvious if I had known what the Pacific actually looks like, but just curious. All right, Edison, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, so my question is about the anointing at Bethany, Matthew chapter 26. May you please give me your take on that, Mr. Heschenmeyer, and most especially verse 11. Quite don't really understand that. The poor you always have with you, yeah. But you always not have me.
Yes, I'd be happy to. There are a couple of anointings if you compare the four Gospels. The first one is in Luke 7, I believe. There's a sinful woman who comes and anoints the feet of Jesus, and he's in the house of someone named Simon. And so it's clearly a different anointing than the one that you're describing in Matthew 26, but it seems to be the prelude to it. So a woman who we're told was a sinner anoints the feet of Jesus and washes his feet with her tears and then dries them with her hair. And so it's clearly an act of love. It's also an act of repentance. And Jesus uses this as an opportunity to teach about how those who've been forgiven much love much. And that's not about his death, but it is this incredible expression of love for Jesus. And one that was very controversial. It's worth kind of reading. And that is the prelude to the second anointing that also happens in the house of someone named Simon, presumably the same house and the same woman, but we're not told explicitly. If it is the same woman, we know who the woman is the second time. We know that it's Mary of Bethany. And so traditionally, it's been understood that it's the same person. But in the second one, which is recounted in John 12, as well as in Matthew 26, she comes and anoints. This time she anoints Jesus's head, and she does it with a pound of costly nard. And so it's a bigger expression, and it's so big. It's so over the top in terms of the expense, in terms of just the seeming opulence of it, that one of the disciples, John tells us it was Judas, protests and says, well, couldn't that money have been given to the poor? And Jesus makes it very clear that that's the wrong kind of question. And he says in John's version, in John chapter 12, verse 7, let her alone, let her keep it for the day of my burial. The poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. That, I think, makes it clear what's going on in Matthew 26, that when he says the poor you'll always have with you, what he means is, look, if you're actually worried about doing nice things for poor people, there's no shortage of opportunities to do that. You'll always be able to take care of the poor. You won't always be able to anoint the body of Jesus for his burial. This is a really special occasion, a really special event. She has the opportunity before the death of Christ to anoint him in this way. Yeah, because of that, this is like a singular, exceptional sort of thing. And so I think drawing back from that, one of the things we can take away is this. People will regularly complain if you spend money on God. If you buy yourself a nice house, if you buy a new car, if you buy yourself nice clothes, if you go on vacation, people aren't going to give you a lot of flack about it usually. But if you build a beautiful church, people will say, well, couldn't you have spent that money on the poor? And they're just repeating Judas's tired question. And Jesus's point is stop pitting money spent on God against money spent on the poor. If you're actually worried about spending money on the poor, go do it. There's no shortage of opportunities to do it. But if you're not going to do that, and in the case of Judas, he's stealing money anyway, it's not like he actually concerns himself with the poor. If you're not going to do that, don't complain about people who take these special opportunities to honor God. Does that clarify what the passage means? Like, the poor you'll always have with you, unlike Jesus in the flesh, who you won't always have with you.
Does that make sense?
I like the explanation. Yes, it does greatly. Worth listening it over and over again.
Thank you, Edison. And I really appreciate you calling from tomorrow.
Yes. See you from the future.
Okay. All right. Well, we're never going to catch
spoilers.
You, though.
No spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers. I appreciate that. I looked at a map, and my question wasn't that dumb. I mean, Guam is farther away than New Zealand is from Tonga.
Are you announcing that while we were having a conversation about the Bible, you were over there?
I was looking at a fascinating map of the South Pacific. I have no idea what the two of you just talked about. I've been doing this 5 years, Joe. I can get the work done. 888-318-7884, the number, open forum. Lots and lots of folks on the line. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Let's go to Vince, a little closer to home, right here in California, in Roseville, California. Beautiful Roseville, California, one of the most beautiful towns in this state. Vince, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Well, hi, Si. Thank you for that. I actually work for the city of Roseville, so appreciate that.
You guys do a nice job up there.
Well, thank you. And I'm actually just here for the free book now, so I don't know. That was my question.
You got a free compliment. I'm not.
But which book?
Oh, that's right.
Oh,
okay.
That's a good question. Well, since we have the anniversary boy, I think I have to go with size. I'm sorry, Joe. But
all right.
That's all right.
I'm going to send you a copy of my book for free, Vince. But just out of curiosity, do you have any idea what the title of it is?
Oh, gosh. I'm drawing a blank.
That's okay. That's okay.
I have to be honest.
Oh, that's all right.
I have a little bit of stage fright. So.
I was just saying today. Well, never mind. It's not the most memorable title in the world. It's not Pope Peter, but it's called A Teacher of Strange Things. I'm going to send it to you. But go ahead with your question for Joe, because I'm realizing we're the clock is a ticking.
Okay, I'll make it quick. Joe, I recently was listening to another prominent Catholic YouTuber, and he had a guest on there that was mentioning that. Basically, if you're a Catholic, you can't invest in 401ks or most of the investment options we have as Catholics, let's say for retirement, you know, really do cooperate with evil, and there's not a whole lot of options. So I did read the article on Catholic.com written by Jimmy, and it was a really good article. So I was wondering if you can kind of expand on it. Should we as Catholics basically stop investing in our 401ks as employees? Should we? Yeah, should we basically, how do we prepare for retirement, you know, given the state of the world that we live in? So
that's a really good question. And in technical terms, there's three types of cooperation with evil. There's formal cooperation with evil. You're just directly doing an evil thing or helping out with an evil thing. You know, you drive the getaway car for someone robbing a bank, or, you know, you help rob the bank. That's cooperation with evil in the most direct sense. That's always immoral. There's also what's called material cooperation with evil. And material cooperation, there's two types, proximate and remote. And it's really a spectrum in terms of how close, which is what proximate means, like how closely you're cooperating with the evil. If you pay someone to get an abortion, that's material cooperation, but it's so close, that's always forbidden as well. On the other hand, if you like employ people and they go and spend your money on drugs or on abortion or on fill in the blank, you've still materially cooperated with the evil, but you're much further away from it. That's what's called remote material cooperation. And so proximate material cooperation, closely cooperating, and formal material cooperation, formal cooperation, are always forbidden. But remote material cooperation is not always forbidden. It's a case by case. And unfortunately, a lot of investment decisions are in that category where it's not an easy, just like you can never do it. You have to take a close look at, like, am I too closely cooperating? Is there a better alternative? Those kinds of questions. There's not going to be a one-size-fits-all sort of answer.
Vince, thanks very, very much. I appreciate it. I'm interested in that question because I've thought for a long time we need more ethicists helping us think through investing choices in the Catholic world. We just don't have enough who are devoted to that. Maybe we'll work on that. Thanks, Vince. Hang on for your book. Joe, you hang on for another hour.
Sounds good.
All right. If you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, it's open forum, 888-318-7884. Right back after this.